on House Behind the Cedars is 1925. Right. And it opened in Steelton.
It opened in Philadelphia first.
In Philadelphia first. Uh-huh.
I met Charlie in January of 25, and a couple of months later, no. I met him when the picture was shown there in Philadelphia, in January of 1925.
Yeah.
Now that is so, absolutely straight.
So then 1925 for?
For the House Behind the Cedars was, and I don't know if that was the initial showing. I believe, I'm persuaded to think that was its premiere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I appeared with it, and I got more money for the appearance than I did for making the film. So you know I remember that quite well.
Now, Michelle was supposed to have made a film called Marcus Garland.
Marcus Garland. I don't know anything about that.
And it was supposedly based on
Marcus Garvey.
Right. And I'm very curious to find anybody who has seen or knows anything at all about that.
Yes,
film.
Yes.
Because it would be interesting from the point of view of the image of Garvey, how he was perceived by people who were living at the same time, and who, whether they were a part of the movement or not, what their reaction to him was, and especially in a mass media like film, he would have been treated.
Yes, I was going to say, how would Michelle treat that? Yes. Michelle himself, how would he treat that? Let me see. Then they had quite a showing of The House Behind the Cedars in New York, in the leading colored theater there. I don't know what the name of it is anymore. With the crowds that jammed that theater, they would push and shove to get in, you know. And this particular night, the opening night, I appeared in evening attire, of course, and the manager of the theater brought me from the rear of the house down the stage, you know, and they had a spot on us. And as we were walking, a whole row of people stood up and said, "Hi, Steelton!" And there must have been
they followed you
10 or 12 people, no, from Steelton who lived in New York City.
Oh, I see what you mean. There are people who, I mean, they didn't come from Steelton.
But
they were living.
And they just all got together on the telephone, called each other, because you know how people go from a little town to a big city, they sort of stick together. And it was really, I was almost in hysterical. I was laughing. This gentleman was holding my hand, you know, because I heard Alex Stevens' big mouth. He's a lawyer in New York. His brother was a member of the legislature in New York. A couple of the girls were nurses in New York. A couple were school teachers. And they were all came out that night. So you can imagine how I felt. But that was one of the pleasant vignettes of my experiences, you know, that particular night. Yeah. And that had to have been 1927.
Mm-hmm. You also mentioned, I think, when we were having lunch, that your mother or your sister had bought stock in Michelle's company. Well, there seems to have been quite a bit of that, because he was such a great talker, of individuals who were impressed by him, who would buy stock in film.
Yes.
So the suggestion that all of these little companies were merely a colored frontage is not accurate. That all of these little companies, there were a number, about 30 or 40 of these companies making colored pictures, and they had listings of presidents and so on, all of whom were themselves colored.
Mm-hmm.
And we can talk about that as a genre of film. Mm-hmm. Films made by blacks for black audiences and so on. And some of the criticism has been that these were in effect really not black companies, black owned companies. But everything that I've read in terms of the little stockholders were individuals who bought small shares, so there was an enormous support. Apart from the fact that people went to see them, they also invested money in them.
True. In Harrisburg, for example, he did very well selling stock. there, and a few people in Steelton bought, and meanwhile he was selling his books, and was taking orders for his books.
In the movie house, or wherever the...
In the homes, when he'd come into the home to sell stuff, you see, then he'd tell them about his book. You see, and he would sell, nearly every place he went, they at least would buy the book. If they didn't buy $100 worth of stuff, they said, "Well, I'll buy a book." And so he got big orders for books in that manner, and that subsidized also. His,
right, he used. Yeah, yeah. He talks about that early in 1919 in a letter to George P. Johnson. He talks about this was before. This was 1918 before. The first film was made. He talks about the potential of films from novels, and he talked with such authority that one had the impression he knew, but in effect he didn't really know what he was really talking about with it. It was possible for him to make, because he'd already sold his book, and he had that experience with selling a book directly. He would be able to sell more books if he had a film based on the book. And that way he could, you know, hopefully make a fortune. What also interests me is that Michaud also claims to have had foreign representatives and have sold the rights outright to many of his films to European distributors.
Well, that did not happen when I was working in his office. I would have known about that.
Yeah. Now, when you were in his office from 1921.
You see, even while I was making films for him, I was still in his office. And we'll say from 1921 to 1923 or 24.
Okay. Yeah, because this is the letter. The letter is just after The Brute was made, which is 1920. So it's possible that he sold the rights outright to The Homesteader and The Brute. And I'm very anxious to know about those, because my next gesture in trying to find those films would be to try to search out somewhere in Europe to see if maybe somebody had prints of those. It's possible they may turn up. Or at least
by the way, now when did his wife die?
I don't know.
Is she dead?
I don't know that she's dead. She was alive in 1972. At least 1972, and she was living in Montclair, New Jersey. Now, I had a number for her, a telephone number, but she was staying pretty much out of it. I would never really get through to her. And in discussions with other people, some people suggested that because there had been so many legal problems in Michaud's career and criticism of him, that she wanted to stay clear of that.
Well, I could appreciate that. I would suppose that. I would suppose that his affairs were in very bad shape. Honestly, I would suppose that. But even so, if you could get an audience with her, she should be pretty elderly now.
Yeah.
I was a brat in relation to her as far as age is concerned.
Yeah.
At least I think I was.
But I will try and pursue
her again.
But
if you can get to see her and sit down with her, she just, I don't know if this would even mean anything, but just say Shingzi Howard thought that I really should sit down and talk with you. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if that would have any bearing on at all.
Yeah.
Of course, she would know who Shingzi Howard is.
Right.
And then give her my warm regards, too, you understand?
Right.
But she could be... So now she could be confused, you know, you never know after,
it's hard to
pass my age, honey, anything can happen. Because I'm at the place now where I don't remember anything.
Oh, well, my memory is failing. What about, let's see, that's 1931, The Exile. That was his first talking picture. Prior to that, all the films were silent. He did The Gonzales Mystery. 1921.
Who did he have in that?
Lon Chenault, Evelyn Prier, Ed Abrams, Mabel Young, Louis DeBolger. You mentioned his name, did you?
No.
DeBolger?
No.
E.G., it's Tatum. It's not Tatum, it's Tatum, T-A-T-U-M. Maddie Wilkes, Inez Klaus, C-L-O-U-G-H?
There is an Inez, but that isn't a name. There was an Inez who was quite an actress. I was hoping you'd call her name.
Oh, it may come up yet.
Yes. Inez, it was an Inez, and she was a leading lady. And she was a little spitfire, but a fine actress.
Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of this information comes from, as I said, George P. Johnson, who is an elderly gentleman now. When he compiled this, I think, much after, I think he must have compiled this fairly recently and relied heavily on his memory.
Oh, yeah.
So that some of the names may not be
correct.
Although, in the correspondence, when Michaud talks about who he's engaged to appear in a picture, we can check up on, on the correction. But the list I'm reading from is a list of, supposedly a list of all the things which Michaud made during his career.
Well, now, he made a picture and had the word seminal. And it seems to me it was something like the Virgin of Seminole.
The Virgin, yes. I've seen that title. I've just got some microfilm.
Well, I was in there.
The Virgin Seminole. I think that's the title of it. And it would, yes, The Virgin of the Seminole, 1922.
Well, there
and
you are.
Yes, and the only listing I have of an actor in it is Will E, W-I-L-L, capital E, Fountain.
Yeah, there was a sample. What was his first name? His first initial? E. Fountain, you say?
Yeah.
E. Fountain. Can't help you out, but I was the leading lady in that.
Okay. Yeah, that's The Virgin of the Seminoles, 1922,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
Chancy Howard.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I didn't know. What was that about? Was that, that wasn't based on, it had nothing to do with the play.
The play, what play?
The Seminole. There was a play on Broadway, I think.
No. He wrote this. This was a script.
Oscar Michaud wrote the script.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And don't ask him what it was all about because I don't remember. We made it in pieces here and pieces there and pieces there. But I think we made that one in Florida.
Uh-huh. He apparently did quite a bit of shooting outside of New York.
Did because, you see, he didn't have money enough to rent a studio. And most of his stuff was done outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
So much of it was outdoor exposure.
And that's for lighting, too.
What?
That's for lighting, too.
Yeah, it's for lighting, yes.
Easier and cheaper, and also because he was non-union.
Non-union?
He
was
ducking. He couldn't.
Oh,
he had to
duck
the police and everything.
He had such a head. And sometimes the cast would get against him. Well, here we go again. Let's hope we don't get picked up. Taking scenes of people's homes and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
We never broke in, though.
you sort of substantiated earlier that Michaud did have a knack for seeing somebody's house he liked.
Oh, yes.
And sort of arriving later with or without permission.
Yes.
To shoot in that house.
Yes, we've done that.
Yeah, I was told that was true of the scene up in Westchester with a house. There's nobody in it,
mm-hmm.
except the girl who arrives,
yes.
Willoughby Guilford, and there's this whole scene that she has in the house itself.
Yeah.
that's interesting.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Let's see, then there are a couple of others you might, oh, here's Andrew Bishop, Lem Hawkins Confession. That's Andrew Bishop, Dorothy Van Engel, and Clarence Brooks.
Clarence Brooks, that rings a bell to
me. Now, Clarence Brooks was an actor in Hollywood movies, wasn't he?
That I couldn't tell. I don't know.
See,
I told you wouldn't get much out of me.
No, I thought you were doing fine. We're doing fine. With your little bits and my little bits, we'll put together a whole lot. Homestead of Lem Hawkins. The Millionaire, 1927. That's Gracie Smith. And Jay Lawrence. J. Lawrence Kreiner.
There you are.
Right.
Would you like to hear an interesting story?
Yes.
That was the first man I ever fell in love with.
Oh.
I loved that man, so it wasn't even funny. And you know, I just thought I would die. That he wouldn't, tumble for me. And one day he says, I can't fool with a virgin. And we were going across the Mississippi River, that bridge, going in the north.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, Lord, let us die right now. Wanted to die with him. I'm 18 years old, girl. And when my husband, when I first met Tara, he said to me, how's Kreiner?
He knew about
Kreiner. He knew about this. Torn love affair.
Yeah.
Yes, dear.
Mm. Then there's Lionel Menangis.
Oh, he was so good to me.
Cleo Desmond.
Cleo, yes. She wasn't nice to me at all when I first went on the stage. She gave me the cold shoulder, and she could have helped me so much. And she just couldn't. There was nothing to keep her from liking me. And finally we became very good friends. But at first, when I joined the Lafayette Players, they were coming, all the arrangements had been made with my mother and Andrew. And they were coming from New York on their way to Nashville. And the train came through Harrisburg nearly at midnight at night. And he came up the steps into the station where my mother had me. And of course, the pleasantries were made, and then he took me down to the train. And in those days, you had to sit up, you see.
Yeah.
And when he seated me, then he left me at my seat. I went to another part of the train. And I could see out of the corner of my eye that there was a colored lady on the opposite. And I turned slightly. And it was Cleo Desmond. I recognized her because I had seen her so often. She knew who I was. She knew that I was the new girl coming on the stage. But she didn't make any overtures to speak to me, anything like that. And this was on Saturday night, and the next day was Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And girl, I cried all day Sunday. I couldn't eat on the train. I was just so homesick and just so sad, and it was a miserable day for me. And she's still
pretty good ones
to go. And she's coming. You'd come up again.
You want me to turn it off?
Yeah.
It's back on now. You know what most of us like that.
I'll be careful.
Okay. I hear there are some more names here that I'm sure you might recognize. In the same movie, The Millionaire, there's William Edmondson.
William Edmondson. That rings a bell, too.
Yeah, Vera Bracker.
No.
S.T. Jackson. Robert S. Abbott and Family.
Mm-hmm.
That probably was a comedy team, if not a singing group. And then, of course, the other thing about The Millionaire was, this was 1927. Michelle.